Ideas matter. Ideas matter. This is Dialogue.
Hello and welcome to Dialogue. Two forums focused on democracy were held in Asia during the same week, one in South Korea and one here in Beijing. Who and what defines the concept of democracy in today's modern age? What is the ideal way to practice democracy for better governance? And what are the threats to democracy today? With the advent of effective AI and as disinformation becomes more convincing and gains more unchecked momentum. With these questions in mind, I spoke on the sidelines of the forum in Beijing to Peter Kagwanja, President and Chief Executive of the Africa Policy Institute. Welcome to Dialogue, Professor Peter Kagwanja. You know, democracy, we talk about democracy, you know, every country has their own style, own characteristic about the democracy, practicing democracy, different systems. But ultimately, it's about like the governance, whether there's good governance or poor governance, whether it delivers, whether it meets the expectation and demand of the people. Is that the way we should understand democracy?
Yes. One thing is that democracy was defined as the government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And therefore, it is the people that defines what democracy is. If they are happy, it is a democracy. If they are served very well, it's a democracy. The tendency in the world today is to weaponize democracy as an ideology to show which culture is more superior to the other. In the West, they say, we are exporting democracy. Like democracy is an orange or oranges to be exported to other people, which is not true. So that is weaponization of democracy for the purpose of demeaning others, for the purpose of dominating others psychologically. The truth of the matter is that the world is not divided between democracy and autocrats. Because when you look at China, for example, it has managed to lift about almost 800 million of its people out of poverty. Whereas many of the, let's say, American, particularly the African Americans, who are my kith and kin, are still wallowing in poverty. So who would you say is democratic? So democracy, it's true, is found in every culture. It is found in every civilization. The difference is the setting, the environment in which democracy thrives. In Africa, our democracy is guided by consensus. We sit at a tree, talk and talk until we agree, and then we move together. Here in China, it's guided by harmony, the harmony between the government, the party, and the people. That's what democracy means here. In the US, it is about who wins and who loses. So there must be an opposition. Even when it does not exist, you have to create one, because democracy without an opposition is not democracy. That's the way they think about things. There must be a duel between two combatants. Yet it is possible to go the African way, which is talking until we agree, which we call absolute consensus. And that was the ancient Greece, a form of democracy. So democracy is in every human culture. The difference is how it is practiced and how it is used to benefit the people, its people. The big question that we've been debating here is about the difference between individual rights and the needs of the people. And usually, the material needs of the people prevail. You cannot have individual rights until you are able to satisfy the material needs of the people. And that's why one philosopher said, development is freedom. If you want freedom, you better develop. If you want rights, you better develop. So the material needs trumps, and democracy can never prevail in the conditions of poverty. So the first order question is to deal with poverty. And then you deal with the nitty-gritties of whose individual rights are violated and who are not, which are not violated.
From the latest news, you know, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, he was talking about this disinformation problem, especially in the time of artificial intelligence.
I think it is a problem. I think that's the point that we can all agree upon, and in particular, probably the problem of the U.S.
Yes. Now, if you remember, we have entered a new era called the post-truth era. Mm-hmm. The post-truth era is about lies, misinformation, and disinformation. And therefore, this is one time, if you remember, the British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, said that before the fact wakes up, the lie have gone halfway around the world. Because lies, unfortunately, are sweet and liked, but fact is detested. Now, what we see happening today is that with the rise of social media and the monopoly of the West of most social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, and so on, they monopolize the lies. They monopolize the tools of disinformation. And they also monopolize the tools of misinformation. Now, China has organized itself and gone to the traditional way of countering lies with facts, but this time in a more powerful way. It is true what Bricken is saying, that China is telling its own story. The question is, who should tell China's story? Or is China supposed to keep quiet and listen to others telling its own story? So the Chinese have to tell the story. The question is whether they're misinforming or they're not misinforming. In my own judgment, they are not. What they are doing is to countering lies. Come to Africa, where I hail from, and the Chinese come and build a nice railway that is helping people transport goods, move services from one corner to another cheaply. Then all of a sudden you have this massive propaganda campaign which talk about the death trap. And you wonder, when they were building the transcontinental railway from New York to Los Angeles, they borrowed the money. What are the Africans supposed to do? When they were building the Trans-Siberian railway, the Russians were building the Trans-Siberian railway, they borrowed money. What are Africans supposed to do? When we get money and build our own infrastructure, then the tools of misinformation and lies come in and dump that death trap. And for the last 5 years, we have lived in a situation where, any coin that comes from Beijing to assist the African brothers is seen as part of the debt, debt burden.
You're talking about the railway from Nairobi
to Mombasa.
To Mombasa.
And the one from Djibouti to Addis Ababa.
Addis Ababa.
All this infrastructure which is opening up Africa.
Beautiful
to
projects.
The market.
Yeah.
Wonderful. It's actually what you call global public goods. Mm-hmm. Literally helping the world to open up and reaching the world. Then somebody wanted the Africans poor because they are better off when you are poor, because you can exploit their resources. You can buy their diamonds, their gold for a dime or for nothing. So the fact that these projects are liberating Africa, integrating it into the global market, then lies come in and falsify this and say it is debt burden. Yet 80% of the debt on the African continent is to the World Bank and the West. China has less than 20% of its debt, and much of it for the poor countries is cancelled. Every 3 years when we have a FOCAC summit, in the G20 summit, China usually cancels the debts of the poorest, the least developed countries. Now, the question is, what is happening here? That now China is speaking with one voice because it is a more coordinated machine. In terms of doing its business, if you look at the harmony between the party and the government, the party and the people, it's not what you find in other cultures. Here now, you have Chinese communication network working diadem with the party, with the government, and with the people. That is why Blinken now starts to cry, because lies have no place.
Said that China has increased billions of dollars to increase its presence in Africa, in TV screens, for example, in media. Do African people or African nations think that's something a problem for Africans or for African-China relationship? But why is that a problem? You know, talk about it. Probably that's
I think one of the things we are trying to overcome in Africa, and we are really struggling, is to convince the West that we are equal to them, that we are not grown-up babies, that we can think for ourselves, that we can choose our friends, and we would have varied reasons to choose our friends and keep them. This is what Nelson Mandela used to tell them when they would go, when he would go to New York, and they start lecturing him about whether he should go to Cuba or he should go to Libya or such countries. And Nelson Mandela would not blink. He would tell them, you can go and jump into the swimming pool because you have no right to choose friends for us, because we know who our friends are. Those who are with us during the struggle, Cuba, Libya, and others. I think this is the same thing we must say today, that Africa has the capacity to choose its friends. Two, we have the capacity to know what is good for us. You don't need anybody else to tell you what is good for you. That is imperialism. Now, China has one thing going for it. In 1980, in Africa, which has 55 countries, only two were poorer than China. By 1980. Yeah, only two were poorer than China. Mm-hmm. The rest were richer than China. Today, China is the world is one of the world's greatest economies. And we are beginning to see a country that has created 500 million of its people into a middle class, the largest middle class in human history and in one country. What does that mean? That the Chinese market is the market of choice. Of 140 countries globally have China as its top market. So that means that Africa cannot sit back and begin and continue with its pro-West policies blindly without looking at other examples that are going to help us pull our people out of poverty. There's no grudge against the West. There's no grudge against anybody. It is in our interest to pull our people or to lift our people out of poverty. And the best example you have today is that of China. And China has not done so by colonizing or oppressing any country. It has not done so by declaring war on any specific country. It has, for the last 40 years, I cannot recall where China was at war with any country. The inverse is true of other superpowers, that they thrive by basically unleashing violence and war against other countries, whether it is within the coalition of the willing, the coalition of this. All these are coalitions of war. The world need a break. Mm-hmm. We need peace. We need harmony. And we need equality among nations. Whether they are small or big, they need to be respected. I think that's what Africa is crying out for. We are crying for global democracy. I know there is a lot of preaching about how African countries should be democratized. Yes, as we democratize our countries, let us also democratize global governance.
When you talk about this democracy, of course, transparency is very important. The free flow of information is important. But think about Assange. Think about Mr. Snowden, exiled or being imprisoned for telling the truth. What does that reveal about, say, Blinken's love of truth or facts or information rather than, or against the disinformation?
It's not true, because it means that if lies are told about other people, you are comfortable and you are ready to literally even sponsor them or underwrite them. But if lies are told, or if the truth is told about you, you don't want it, even by your own people. And therefore, this is a classic case of what we are calling the post-truth order. And the sponsors of the post-truth order are going to punish those who tell the truth and reward those who are going to tell lies on their behalf. And therefore, we are having a system of double standards, sponsored largely by the West. It is not about hard power. It's not about soft power. It's not about smart power. It's about sharp power.
Sharp power.
And sharp power is about lies, disinformation, misinformation, and literally going out of your way to live on lies and lies and lies.
Well, lastly, you know, when you know viewers, readers, when the next time found negative stories from, say, accusations from the U.S. government or negative stories about China, what's your advice for them?
I think I would have advice for China, because I'm familiar. We're going to take time before we say we change the adversarial tendencies of Western culture. We're not likely to change it. The only thing you can do is to strengthen your capacities to speak the truth. Strengthen your architecture of literally telling the truth about your relationships, about your relationship with Africa, about your relationship with Asia, about your relationship with Latin America. Your instruments of communication must be so strong that and committed to the truth that lies have no place. And until you overwhelm lies, the world cannot be safe. Until you build enough jails and lock in thieves, you cannot say that the villages or our communities are safe. Lies are the greatest danger to our civilization today. Misinformation and disinformation are the threat to our democracy today. And therefore, China has a moral responsibility to invest in instruments of truth, instruments of communicating the truth so that the world can be safe.
Thank you, Professor Peter Kawanja.
Thank you.
Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Get a balanced analysis on both domestic and international topics within the framework of cross-cultural comparisons. This is Dialogue.
Also on the sidelines of the forum, I talked to Professor Alfred Honnum, Chair of English and American Studies at the Johannes Gutenberg University of Mainz, and discussed how serious political and trade competition between China and America is impacting both sides. Welcome to Dialogue, Professor Honnum. You know, the focus often is about the relationship between China and the U.S. And how do you describe this relationship so far? And, China, from our understanding, is trying to define this relationship with, cooperation. But the U.S. side, at least, in the past few years, is about, confrontation, competition, or even conflict. How do you see this current status between the two countries?
Well, this is very interesting because whenever I'm here in China and teach, I spent a year at Beida doing research and teaching courses. All of the students are very interested about the United States, actually want to go study in the United States, though there must be something that makes the United States attractive to Chinese in the same way in which I know when I'm in the United States that many Americans also want to go to China to study. This is a very interesting aspect about the relationship between the two countries that, in my mind, they are very similar. There are a lot of systems that are equal. I think that the quality of education, the idea that you want an elite education and excellence, is very prominent in China and is very prominent in the United States. So this is a very good aspect. What makes the difference, and I mean, when I was here in 2009, Barack Obama was elected president, the first non-white president of the United States, who had a multinational approach to politics because of his own background. Born in Hawaii and then, living in Indonesia, going to school in Indonesia, so he's Asian trained, he's black. All of this makes for a different approach. And I gave a lot of talks about Barack Obama's autobiography and Chinese students were very interested in that. So I think what we call the confrontation between the United States and China acts on a political, ideological level, which we as scholars and people who are interested in ideas and philosophies have long come over and transcended. I think this is what we need to stress, you know, the commonalities, the ways in which people who present ideas cooperate, like Confucius. I mean, this is my research topic that I have worked on, yeah.
That's an interesting, you know, aspect. You know, you are known for your study, your research, you know, outstanding research about the United States, and also you contributed to the idea, or you raised the idea, actually, the U.S. founding fathers, yeah, heavily influenced by Confucius, your Confucian values. Tell us more about that.
Well, first of all, I mean, the translation of the Analect and the Confucius works by Jesuit scholars, which was published in Paris in 1687, automatically opened up what I now could call a multipolar interest in the way in which societies develop. Because immediately when this book was published, the intellectual community of Europe, you know, they were all interested in it. At the time, this was the Latin community. People spoke Latin in the universities, right, like we speak English or Chinese today. And I found it very interesting that the German philosopher, Georg Leibniz, he wrote a response to this, also in Latin, called The Newest in China. And he makes two important points. One is that Chinese could become and should be a cosmopolitan language. And the second one is to say that the Europeans can learn from China, simply because the Chinese have a more practical approach to learning and teaching, and that the theoretical part is something that many Europeans enjoy. So he said the Chinese should come to Europe in order to get the Europeans to lose their corrupt regimes, you know, to change the corrupt monarchies to different forms of culture and different forms of government.
Mm-hmm. Earlier, you talked about the transcending the ideological differences, political differences, you know. Nowadays, when people talk about China and the U.S., in particular, I would say in the U.S., you know, when they talk about the relationship, often it's opposing views, like in a black and white manner.
Yeah.
And it seems like very hard to find something in common. But before that, you know, you can see, you know, there are a lot of people-to-people exchange, a lot of learning from each other.
Yeah.
How can we transcend in terms of, in the political sense, or in the country-to-country relationship here? Transcending the differences, and then say we probably cooperate for the sake of, for example, handling the common threat from climate change and other like transnational.
Well, that's the point. I mean, that many of the issues that we are now concerned with are not nationally based, but they are transnational or world community problems, you know, like the global warming, the environmental changes touches all of us. When Corona happened, it is not a local issue. All of a sudden, it's a world issue. And we need to find ways in which to handle this on a global scale rather than on a nationalistic kind of level. And this is, I think, what we need to go beyond. We have to do local politics, but at the same time with an international spirit in mind, a global kind of community. And we certainly do need a reform. I mean, this is one of the issues that were being discussed. We need to rethink the kind of constellations that have existed between different countries of the West and the former East and the South, global South, you know, in order to make international organizations more inclusive. I mean, for a long time, I mean, the Security Council of the United Nations is a composite of nations that has not changed since the inception of the United Nations in 1949, but the nations that are in the Security Council don't want to change it. So China is a member of it, Russia is a member of it. They could, you know, start trying to change it. and bring in people of the BRICS country, you know, more like Russia and China are already BRICS, but others that could then transform the picture, the complete picture.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, I think, you know, for Germany and also for the European Union, when you look at relationship with China, you know, a bit of change, let's say, you know, not only as a partner, but also as a rival or competitor, as like a, you know, three levels relationship here. What has changed? Is that the influence of the Washington's China policy, or is that the change of the reality? Or
well, what has changed is maybe that the economic shifts have taken place. China, of course, is the second power in the world now, aspiring to be the first. And this will probably happen soon, I guess. And also the transformation of the economy that has taken place in the sense that China now doesn't need German cars anymore, you know, because you produce much better electronic e-cars. So this kind of change the German automakers have missed. They should have started this a long time ago. Now they see that their cars are not being sold anymore. So this changes the picture, of course, in the economic level. As far as the cultural exchanges are concerned, I think nothing has changed.
Mm-hmm. What about the geopolitical level?
Geopolitically, I mean, we are now seeing two wars going on, which, of course, influence the picture greatly. And, you know, we have heard a lot of talk today about the sovereignty of states that is intact and should not be, you know, attacked. So this is an issue which is divided in opinions between Western nations and the global South. So this is an issue that exists at this point, but I think what is again needed is the idea that Confucius preached and Laozi and so on. We need to communicate, we need to talk to each other rather than be silent, you know, and distance each other. We need communication.
Thank you, Professor.
Yeah.
Thank you for speaking with us.